You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. My name is Lyle Troxell, and via Skype with me today, I have Mr. Miles Elam. Hello, Miles.
Good morning.
Good morning. So we'll have to figure out your volume level. I think that will work out. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speaker are not necessarily those of KUSP. All right. Well, let's go ahead and jump into the news, Miles, if that's okay with you, sir.
That works out for me. A story that I wanted to cover a couple of weeks ago, but unfortunately we had other priorities, such as pledge drives.
Always
and,
important.
Yeah. this one I thought was worth it, even though it's a little older as a story, which is a high school student in Indiana was expelled for tweeting profanity. Now, you might think, one, profanity, isn't that a little, isn't expelling someone a little extreme?
Yeah, it seems like it.
I mean, has anyone been in a local high school or middle school and listened in the halls for profanity? It's not a rare occurrence. And yet this high school, the reasoning for it was that he had used a school computer to tweet this. The problem is that the school computer was a school-issued laptop that he had at home, and he was tweeting at 2 a.m.
From his bedroom, probably.
From his bedroom, yes.
And got expelled for doing that.
Yes, he did.
Why are the officials at his school paying attention to what he does on Skype? On Twitter.
Yeah, their statement was that because it was done on a school property, on that laptop, that it was reflective of the school itself.
Mm-hmm.
That said, it was because he started up the laptop, he didn't realize that every time you start the laptop, it opens up a VPN connection, virtual private network, to the school.
Right.
So that tweet was done from the school IP, even though he was at his own home.
Okay, so virtual private network, the idea behind it really is so that you can be remote and securely tunnel all your traffic into a private network. And this is really important because lots of services at a company or at a school are restricted to only work inside the private network. And that gives you a level of protection so that your different services at the company, at the school, whatever, is not available on the entire internet. And it's a pretty smart way of handling that problem. Let's say you want to connect to a database server or something, you want to do some work. If you make sure that your private network is really secure, and then those applications don't have to have the same level of scrutiny because they're not open to everybody. They're only open to people that are trusted, that are in the building. And then home networking comes around and people go, well, how do you make that same person safe? And you just do this virtual private network, this tunneling effect, where when you connect your computer, the service is all to get kind of routed through this other network. And he didn't even know that was happening.
Right.
Why?
Well, that's the assertion he's making.
Right.
And which is a plausible one.
Yeah, probably because the school was locked at 2:30 in the morning, you think.
Well, not just that, but I mean, you have to expect a certain technical savvy of students to know that a VPN connection is being made in the background from your laptop.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when you set up VPN, to do it right, you don't really want to have to do a lot every time you do it.
You want it to happen automatically for a lot of students. It's just that if they don't know that it's happening, then you're not going to know the implications of, oh, well, it's going to be routing through the school network and then going up to Twitter and, yeah.
Yeah. Now, this is really interesting because, of course, the service of the school, I don't know why the school is giving out laptops, but I'm not surprised that it would do it. One of the impetus...
It's actually becoming a lot more common.
Yeah. And one of the reasons to do it partially is that it equalizes the footing of everyone at the school, right? If you only let the students that have money use laptops because their parents can afford them, then when you have kids that don't have the kind of money to have a laptop, they're actually they don't have the same types of tools available to them. And of course, as everything gets, you know, you get rid of paper, you start getting rid of a lot of cost, recurring costs at a school. It really is wonderful when you can rely upon everyone having electronic means. So they're giving away, so they're allowing students to take laptops home to do their work. And the students, of course, are using a laptop, a personal device. They're using it for their own purposes. I think the tunneling thing is the real thing that got us here, right? I mean, but at the same time, it's kind of important to note that when you do take school property home with you, for example, there are some downsides of it. All of a sudden, school rules apply inside your house. I mean, I think that clearly this should be overturned and it should become really clear when VPN is on, when VPN is off, and what is personal time and what can the school manage.
Right. And this is a similar issue that people have wrestled with in the professional world with regard to, is the laptop that's company issued one that you can use for other purposes? Is the cell phone that's company issued one that you can use for other purposes?
Right.
And it's very fuzzy and it's very organization specific.
Absolutely. Mr. Ben Jaffe just joined us. Ben is a programmer, a web programmer, and sometimes Stanford instructor. And hi, Ben.
Hi there. I also have a working alarm, but I turn it off and I go back to sleep.
Where'd you come in from?
Sunnyvale today.
Yeah, that's a pretty bit of a drive. Here is in Santa Cruz, about a block from the beach, and Miles is somewhere else as well. But he knew that. He didn't sleep in. He just knew that we would be remote
it's,
with that.
It's so interesting psychologically, too, because when you know you're going to be late, then the slow drivers are even more infuriating than if you don't know if you're going to be late.
It is the crucial time to breathe while driving. You just can't accept,
right.
I will be late.
Like, and yet, when you are not late, you are one of those drivers that's pissing the other people off.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's true.
Wow.
Well, we just covered this interesting story about a kid getting suspended from school. Expelled or suspended?
Yeah, because he was tweeting.
Expelled from school because he was tweeting from his bedroom.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing of
over
it,
the VPN, yeah.
That was the trick, yeah, mm-hmm, yeah, mm-hmm. Definitely. Oh, you heard the radio.
Yeah, which made it even more frustrating because that's when I was stuck behind the person. I heard
and you wanted
the
to
show.
Participate.
It's like, oh, right. Man.
And just as a point of reference as well, he was a senior, which means that he was almost done.
Ooh,
and that tweet was not referring to the school at all.
Was he an adult? Sometimes seniors are adults.
I don't have any information about how old he is.
Yeah. All high school students are young adults.
I'm always curious about that stepping point between, you know, you're in high school, you're 17, and then all of a sudden you're 18 one day, and it's a completely different world for you. You're still doing the exact same thing. I had a bit of legal issues at school when I was that age, where I ran into that boundary of, wait a second, I'm a student, but I'm also an adult. You know, how are you treating me? And, you know, why are my parents involved in this, for example?
Why am I suddenly liable for credit card debt?
Exactly. What happened? You used to just go magically away.
Well, that only happened like 42 days ago. I turned 18. So,
right.
But I remember it very well. I remember a lot of people were like, hey, how do you feel? Now you're 18. Now you're an adult. And I feel exactly like I felt yesterday.
Except it's completely your fault when the alarm doesn't go off and doesn't wake you up in the morning, right?
No. It was my fault before.
Hey, are you ready with your news, sir?
I am so ready
with
my news. I have so much news. So at the Catalan Institute of Nanotechnology in Barcelona, they have this very sensitive scale. So up until now, we've been able to measure things down pretty low to the nearest, I think, 100 yoctograms. But now we can actually measure things that are one yoctogram. So
what's a yoctogram?
What is a yoctogram? Right. Okay. So let's go down three orders of magnitude at a time. Okay. So you have a gram. Then you have a milligram. That's 1/1000th of a gram. Then you have a microgram. That's 1/1000000th of a gram. Then you have a nanogram, that's 1/1000000000th of a gram. A picogram is 1/1000000000th of a gram. A femtogram is 1/4000000000th of a gram. An attogram is 1/4000000000th of a gram. A zeptogram is 1/6000000000th.
Yeah.
Thank you. A zeptogram is 1/6000000000th of a gram. And then a yoctogram is 1/7000000000th of a gram.
Okay.
In other words, really, 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 really low mass.
I mean, do we have to name all these things? You know, it keeps going. Couldn't we just use, scientific notation?
On the contrary, it doesn't necessarily keep going. Stop at a certain point because it doesn't make sense from a physics standpoint. It's kind of like the number Google or Googleplex.
Yeah.
For the most part, mathematicians didn't want to accept it because once you get into numbers that big, you're describing more than the number of subatomic particles in the universe.
Right.
So what's the point?
Yeah. why would you do so?
So check this out. What is a yoctogram? This scale can detect a single proton.
Wow.
Yeah. So
why aren't we using moles?
Weigh an atom to the nearest yoctogram and weigh protons. Moles?
Yeah,
like
moles
little
are...
furry things that pop out of them?
They're small.
Yeah, well, they don't have a consistent weight. Some are
a measurement of mass of an atom, right? Or in moles. But is, that's the it's a calculation.
That's
of course,
the so. Number. That's a mole is a number of atoms,
yes.
If I remember correctly. So, and that's not necessarily weight, yeah. Because different atoms weigh different things. So if we're just talking about scales, I mean, I guess you could use however many moles, but then again, if you can weigh a single atom of xenon to the nearest yoctogram, I mean, it's not even like, oh, I can register one atom.
How is this scale working? How do they do this?
I'll just say carbon nanotube magic.
Okay.
Basically, they have these nanotubes and they vibrate at different frequencies depending on the mass of the particle or the molecules that are on them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way it works. Like that, I'm sure that if you went into more detail, you'd probably need a lot more higher science education, math education than I have.
So a yocto is 10 to the minus 24th.
10 to the minus 24th, yes.
Mm-hmm. That is really, really small.
Yeah. Oh, so here's something that kind of helps.
Yeah.
If you go the other way, if you go bigger and bigger and bigger, we have terabytes and petabytes and exabytes and zettabytes. So I think that you can measure all of the data that human beings, that the human race puts out in 1 year in some n number of zettabytes. I don't remember what the number
is.
So
we're not even up to yottabyte.
We're not even up to yottabyte. So if you take all of the data created by humans in a year, or maybe in all time, I'm not sure, probably, and you were to take that, say, 1 over that number of bytes, and then divide it by 1,000, then you get 1 yacht.
That clarifies everything.
Exactly. Well, I don't know. If you want to think about big versus small.
The big versus small.
That's
range,
10 to the 24th is a yottabyte, and 10 to the 21st is a zettabyte. So.
All right. Thank you for the large number math stuff early in the morning.
Teeny.
Back to Mr. Miles Elam. Miles, you've got something about the White House.
Yes, the IP czar. Did you guys know that we have an IP czar?
I've heard about that, yeah. And this is intellectual
property czar.
Okay, czar, property. As in T-S-A-R, czar, or T-Z-A-R?
In the U.S., yeah, we spell it as C-Z-A-R.
Oh,
yeah.
C-Z-A. Oh, okay. Whoa, we have a czar?
Yeah, we have an IP czar.
We have
lots of czars.
Wow. I didn't know that. This is news to me.
What's the White House IP czar doing lately?
The White House IP czar has made a couple of statements. There's a new one on the block, I should say. And his position is that anti-piracy laws should not block free speech. There's been a back and forth about whether or not we should be making IP rules. This is like copyright enforcement, patent enforcement, trademark, more stringent. Having, for example, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act and takedown notices. Like, how far is it protecting the copyright holders, for example, versus allowing certain entities to have too much power, even when something might be fair use? And so anti-piracy comes into play when you have things like, DVDs. And if you copy that DVD and share it, you know, you're sending copies of that. You do not have a license to do so, and you are breaking the law. But if you block the ability for someone to rip a DVD to your hard drive or a Blu-ray disc to your hard drive,
mm-hmm.
is that really stopping piracy, or is that merely preventing the ability for a user to use what they've purchased?
Right. Now, does the czar, is this a man or a woman? Do you know?
This is a man.
Okay. So this czar, is he specifying the kind of granularity of things like, well, we want satire to exist, and therefore it's okay to burn rip DVDs? Or is he saying that just in general, if there's any cause for a free speech aspect, it's okay to do it? Like, is his statement saying it supersedes all copyright infringement laws?
No, it doesn't.
Okay, so he's being
at
more...
At the same time, I have to say I need to slap myself on the wrist, you know,
yeah.
Not a man.
Oh.
U.S. Intellectual Property Enforcement Coordinator Victoria A. Espinel.
You're assuming Victoria is not a man, but...
I was going to say that, yeah.
The person might be. Okay, anyway. Okay, she. Sorry. Victoria Espinel. Espinel?
Espinel, yes.
Espinel. Is declaring... what's the statement?
Her quote is, "Online piracy is a serious problem, but the administration will not support legislation that reduces freedom of expression, increases cybersecurity risks, including authority to tamper with the DNS system, mm-hmm. or undermines the dynamic, innovative global internet."
So it sounds like it's a rational, geeky person that knows exactly... I shouldn't say geeky because I'm just giving a positive aspect to geeky, but it's a rational person that understands the problem and is saying, look, this is a fundamental aspect of what we need to do. We need to protect free speech in this environment. Because that really is one of these side effects that happens over and over again. I mean,
we talked about a couple of weeks ago that notion of we're going to shut down DNS within the U.S. so that it, we don't get routed to another server outside.
Right.
And the technical issues associated with that, not to mention the free speech issues with that.
So Victoria is the international U.S. Intellectual Property Enforcement Coordinator. I don't know if she's actually the czar, but she's definitely one of those people speaking in that office. So to me, it sounds like a perfectly good way to start like the statement, like it's copyright's a serious problem. Free speech is really important. We need to be able to, slide through this line really well. I mean, it's really about navigating that because, of course, the more locked down you are, the better copyright will be protected by the people that own it and the less easy it will be to have free speech. Also, education is a whole aspect of this. We at the university, we constantly have this issue of if you want to study early video games, for example, well, you make sure you get a copy in the library. There's a game library at UCSC. And let's say you only have one copy of that game. How do you check that out to students? That's that physical thing is actually extremely important. And yet you want students to engage in it to do the research they need to do on that. And if you're thinking, wait, game research, is that really a field? Yeah, it's really a big field. Understanding how the art space and the engineering space of game development is a giant industry. And so having a library that can check those items out makes a lot of sense. Well, how do you do that when the actual physical media, it's illegal to copy it, right? Which is ridiculous.
And from a technical standpoint, you can copy those games and run them in emulators on modern computers.
Right.
You don't need a console anymore.
Right, which makes it a lot easier for them, for the library to manage their system, right? They know, instead of having thousands of CDs in a room or DVD cases in a room holding all this media, they instead just have a console in the library where you can go and engage in the game. And that process right there is unclear where the copyright versus, and I don't know if that's free speech space, but I'll go with free speech as the overriding envelope of that. That's a really important thing to be aware of. And I love that the U.S., the White House is saying that, yeah, it's important. That's good. Thanks. I'm sure that's partially feedback from the whole fiasco with laws that, the laws that we recently kind of fought from being implemented. But anyway, let's go on to the next story. Ben, since you're in and I don't have your notes in front of me, so I don't know what you're talking about.
I'm starting to add them to the...
Oh, I see that. Okay, so I can say that you're going to talk about... What? Go ahead.
Okay, so I want to talk about a nearby star which has a number of planets around it. So this is not actually the Kepler mission, although, quick side note, Kepler has 2 more years.
Woo-hoo.
So the Kepler satellite looks for exoplanets. Exoplanet just means a planet that's outside of our solar system. So this particular star I want to talk about, it's called HD 10180.
It just rolls off the tongue.
Well, actually, I read that and I was like, oh my God, that's a really geeky number. HD is high definition. 10180 are 2 freeways I live really close to. And if you take away one of the ones, it's HD 1080, which is
which is kind of like numerology.
A lot like numerology.
Hey, I'm not saying you can tell anything about the star numerology based on its name. But
so it's really good. So they have really good picture quality there.
Right, exactly. Anyway, 9 planets, allegedly. So according to new data, it actually might have 9 planets, which is 1 more than we have, because Pluto is not a planet. Sorry.
And we're pretty sure that these are large bodies, because they need to be relatively large to detect them.
Yeah. Initially, we were looking at Doppler shift signals. In our original analysis of the star, we found 6 planets. 5 of them were like 12 to 25 times that of Earth. And the sixth was much, much, much bigger, like 65 times Earth's mass. But now And also, they orbit with periods of 5 to 2,000 days. Imagine a planet with an orbit of 2,000 days, you know?
That's pretty far away from the sun.
Yeah.
Hey, Miles, you know a bit about calculus and such. Do you want to try to figure out the equation that they can use on a thing that changes from... all you know is how much is vibrating back and forth, but you can infer from that that there are 9 different bodies orbiting it at different rates and different masses. How do you do that? I mean, you give me 2 orbiting things around a body, I'd be like, 4 months.
I have a potential answer to that. I mean, if you look at an audio signal, right, you have multiple instruments playing at the same time and they're all playing different pitches, you get that kind of complex waveform. So,
you know how that calculation works.
I know exactly how it works. Now, you listen to it and you're like, oh, there's something up in that. But it's kind of interesting. I guess if you turn this into audio and you just looped it over and over again, you could hear it.
It's probably the same algorithms, right? The stuff that
probably
determines
same or similar. Although you don't have much data, you know, so you have to do a lot of inference and whatnot. But anyway, these 3 additional planets we found masses of 1.9, and 5.1 times that of the Earth. So they're actually pretty small.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't want to live on them. Because
as planets go,
because the commute would be terrible.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, just imagine, like, I would be late to Geek Speak every week if I lived on one of those planets. Basically, by our standards, we would just say that these planets are being cooked by the star. You know, like they are so hot that they can melt most of many of the elements that are involved in this planet are just like molten on the surface of these planets. So. Anyway, pretty awesome to know that there is a star that's relatively close. It's only 130 light years away, so we just gotta get
down the street.
Well, we just need to find Zefram Cochrane and make sure he invents the warp drive, right?
Right. If we could go at the speed of light, then a human being would still not be able to live to that other planet.
Sir, the warp drive goes much faster than the speed of light.
I will have to counter you by saying no, it doesn't. What? It warps space. It doesn't go faster.
Well, it goes faster to...
Geek Speak on KSP is supported by Home and Small Business Tech, providing IT support to businesses and tech support for home computers. Home and Business Tech specializes in protecting data and have been providing data storage, recovery, virtualization, and maintenance for over 10 years. HASBtech.com. Geekbit, anybody?
I have one.
Okay.
Oh, I already said it. Kepler, 2 more years. Yay.
Yeah, I have one.
Okay.
The computer known as Raspberry Pi. It is a small ARM-based computer, ARM being a type of processor architecture. To make a comparison, just to give people a point of reference, an Intel Pentium chip is x86 architecture. The older Macs were a PowerPC architecture. So a different CPU type. The thing that's interesting about them is that they are going for a base of like $25 and get them for 35. They're these super tiny Linux machines. I mean, I'm talking about Matchbox or smaller that has Ethernet, HDMI, audio, USB.
Yeah. So what, but it doesn't have a hard drive, right?
Right. That's what the USB is for.
Right. So what about Raspberry Pi?
It is finally getting EMC testing, testing to go through for FCC licensing and the like, exposed to electromagnetic radiation to see like what happens with this, you know, how does it react with static electricity?
Right.
And so it's hitting that final lap before it is available to the public.
Somebody's got a geeky crush on Raspberry Pi, I can tell. You're going to get one, Miles?
I'm seriously thinking about it.
Do they spell it P-I-E?
It's not something
P-I?
That you would... P-I.
Oh, cool.
Okay, that's cool.
It's nothing that you would want to run, I don't know, the latest games on.
Mm-hmm.
By any means. You wouldn't even want to run a server, really, on it, unless that server was doing something very, very, very simple. It's so that you can play around with the small embedded device, do, like, one-off, like, set up a... Some of the things that you might use an Arduino for,
mm-hmm.
Except using general tools like Linux
right.
and the C language, as opposed to,
as opposed to a very micro iOS OS. Is this thing have a VGA out and or HDMI out, and does it have audio out as well?
It has HDMI. It does not have VGA.
Yeah, right. And but it does have audio out. So you could technically use this as a streaming server for your home, for like a music server for your home.
If you define music as being something that doesn't do a lot. I mean, this CPU is not
enough.
Very strong.
All right.
But at the same
time...
Well,
when you play with yours, I'd love to find out if it can do an MP3 decoding and play it in real time. Because, I mean, I would assume it can. That's not that powerful. And it sure would be nice to have a... You think that is? That loud doesn't know what he's talking about. Hey, Geeks Begun... Oh, wait. Well, one more Geek.
I have a really quick one. If that was a Geek Bite, this is a Geek Bit.
Okay.
I didn't know this. In all that I know about the Kepler mission and exoplanet stuff, I didn't know we actually can optically image exoplanets. Like, with like getting the light and taking a picture of them. I didn't know that. And we did this in November 13th, 2008. There's a little pixel in the middle of this image that looks like the Eye of Sauron. And I'm going to put that up on geekspeak.org, and you should all take a look at it. It's kind of like the pale blue dot picture.
But it's a different
not
dot.
Earth. And it's from Earth.
Right.
Hubble took a picture of this.
And it's not pale blue, probably.
No, actually, it's kind of red. It looks like the Eye of Sauron.
It's cool.
Like, really, really looks
that
like
doesn't the Eye of Sauron.
Yeah, it freaked me out last night. I found it.
Cool. Optically, exoplanets. I didn't know we could do that either. Geek Speak on KOSP is supported by High Ground Organics, CSA, a family farm delivering weekly boxes of fresh, locally grown organic vegetables, fruits, and flowers to pickup sites throughout the Monterey Bay and Silicon Valley areas. More information is at highgroundorganics.com. We are continuing with our geek news today. We're not taking calls, but we do have a lot of yummy news to talk about, including a story from France. Miles?
Yes, this is along with my peer-to-peer and IP freedom and the like. France has some of the most strict anti-piracy laws in the world. They have a three strikes rule, or maybe it's six strikes, I can't remember off the top of my head, where basically it was saying if you are found using P2P software to download copyrighted works, you know, a certain number of times, you are cut off from the internet.
You no longer get internet access.
Right, which is, that became, caused this whole dust up of controversy with regard to free speech mm-hmm. and whether or not, you know, the internet is a human right or not, or access to information anyway is a human right, that type of thing. And so at the same time, let's look at what the French anti-P2P law has done. And as it turns out, it has cut back on piracy.
Okay, so making it extremely... making piracy really punishable at a federal level.
More draconian. Yeah.
More draconian. That's one way to say it. has decreased the amount of piracy that is happening in France.
Yes.
Okay, that's good from the perspective that they achieved their goal.
Right. Now there's a flip side.
Okay.
The reason for going after piracy,
mm-hmm.
Especially music piracy, was supposed to be because the music industry was losing money because of the piracy.
Right. Okay, so the idea being
that's being stolen from them,
The reason why we try to protect copyright is so that the people that actually have the rights-holding ability can profit from it. And what the music industry has been seeing for a long time is the decrease in sales, and therefore they've said piracy is killing us, you've got to stop it to protect our industry, basically. Okay, go on.
Yes. So from a report released by Hadopi, French ISP users significantly decreased their P2P file sharing. And yet at the same time, the French music industry saw a decline in their revenue.
Really?
In other words, piracy went down, but the revenue continued to go down as well.
Hmm.
This would be what Dr. Don referred to as correlation is not equal causation.
People are listening to less music. They're watching more TV is the problem. I mean, who knows what it is, basically. But people are buying less music. They're probably listening to less music. It seems strange to me. I wonder if because let's just do wild speculation here. Let's say a lot of people have a large library of music on their devices and they're listening to the music all the time. And that's what I'm doing. Probably Ben, you're doing that too. We have really easy access to any music we own. And if we don't and we want to listen to it, we can always rip that CD off our shelf and then we have easy access to it. So we have a giant library of good music. And then we also have the radio. And so the idea, of course, is that you slowly increase your library, you buy more and more, and you have more and more music. But maybe if it's so easy to access your large archive of music, you're less likely to buy new music, engage in new music. That's a possibility, at least.
Well, you're certainly not going to go to the Sam Goodies that no longer exist.
Yeah, that's true.
To buy a CD.
Yeah. And I mean, I definitely spend less money on music than I mean, per song than I used to. You know, CDs used to be $15. A full album now is more like $10 and $12. So that's a little bit less money. Though I'm not getting a physical object, I'm assuming that the people that are selling that music to me are actually making more revenue because they don't have to ship and print and all that stuff, those CDs. So what you're saying
is... certainly is making more revenue.
Yeah, Apple's definitely doing fine. So French anti P2P, I guess it was really about person-to-person networks, that law cutting back piracy. It totally cut back piracy, probably also damaged the P2P infrastructure, which is actually a really great way to share large content on the internet. But it still, the goal, of course, is to protect the music industry, I'm assuming, and it doesn't seem to affect it. Interesting. Thanks for the story.
As a side note, hey, Apple, if you're listening, hey, Apple, if you're listening, we would love to have a P2P download available for iTunes.
Absolutely.
So podcasts could go through BitTorrent.
Oh,
it would
yes.
make podcasting so much more available.
Okay, because, we better cover what we're talking about, Miles. Please explain what BitTorrent is.
BitTorrent is a protocol, and there are many clients out there of various names that allows you to what's called seed a file that may be on your hard drive from a torrent file or from actually. There are other ways of doing so, but let's talk about the base. And then someone else, say, you know, my friend Lyle, then goes to me and says, hey, I want that file. And so I say, okay, here's the first, you know, the first section of that file. And then Ben says, hey, I want that file too. So I go, okay, you can have the second section of that file. And then...
And I say, hey, Ben, I'm finished with the first section. Here's the first section.
Right.
So Lyle and I can actually talk to each other now because we have different parts of the file instead of both having the beginning of it and neither of us having the end.
Right.
And so what that means, Miles, is that you've shared the first section once and the second section once, and both of us have gotten it from each other. So the more people that do this, the less traffic actually hits you per download.
Yes. The amount of traffic that hits me is no longer linear. In other words, it's not a one-for-one. If I have a million listeners, then it's a million times the bandwidth.
Right.
I have a million users, and I'm using 100 times the bandwidth.
Right. This is actually a big reason why GeekSpeak's podcast, there's only 10 of them available in the XML feed, and it's through NPR. Because NPR covers the bandwidth rate for the download. Our full archives on our site, but if I put it in an XML feed that says, here, easily download this, you know, like via a scraping tool, and four or five people do that, the amount of data that gets transferred from the ISP is really going to affect our service and potentially the pocketbook. So I'm in this situation where I can't make available them as an easy download for everybody, like a podcast, because of the traffic impact. But at the same time, if we could provide it via a BitTorrent, well, I can, of course. But if it was easy to implement the iTunes download, any kind of podcasting download through BitTorrent, then I could make all of the shows available as a large feed. And all that would happen is if 3 people that month or 1,000 people that month decide to download it, they're just all going to be downloading it from each other. It's a wonderful way to handle that giant problem of large package delivery. And that's how the Linux packages get distributed now. If you want to download pretty much anything, I think,
well,
in Ubuntu.
You can choose to, yeah.
Yeah. That's a great way to get and it's really fast. I mean, if you're at the campus at UCSC and you do this kind of thing, it's amazing the kind of speed that we're talking about you have tons of people providing the
even if you're not in the campus, if you have, for example, like I do, a 15 megabit connection to my home. Let's say I were serving a file from my home and my upload rate, in other words, going out to the outside, is probably closer to like 2. 2 megabits, something like that. If 10 people try to download from me, that's 2 megabits divided by 10. So they're all going to get that file very slowly.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, if I'm able to give it out by BitTorrent, it means that I can serve more people faster because they're getting it from each other as well, the aggregate bandwidth of all participants. So you're able to get that file so much faster, and I use less bandwidth.
Now, the side of it that scares, that's bad for copy protection enforcement, if you will, assuming that that you take that line of thought, is that let's say somebody starts hosting a song that's owned by somebody else, or a piece of content, a song. And so Michael Jackson's Thriller is now on Ben's computer, and he's sharing it via BitTorrent. And I start downloading it, you start downloading it. As we download it, we actually share it as well. And the entire network that starts downloading it starts sharing it. So all of us potentially are infringing the copyright of the Michael Jackson Corporation, whoever owns it, Michael Jackson's music now.
In much the same way that if you put that Michael Jackson Thriller, ripped it as an MP3 and put it up on a website.
Right. But the trick is
copyright infringement, and so are all the people that are downloading it.
Right. The trick, though, of course, is that if it's at one location on a website, you do a stop and desist from there. You get to the ISP and you say, hey, this company is providing a song that's clearly owned by someone else, and the song is no longer available on the website. In a BitTorrent environment, every one of those people has to get a stop and desist, they're across multiple networks. It's that very interesting side effect of a network.
And they're all distributors.
Yeah, they're all distributors.
Not just downloaders, but distributors as well.
Which is actually the illegal part, copyright infringement, is the actual distributor. But the point is that it's very hard to then turn that off because you have to go after every one of these. Now, the music industry started suing people that were doing this quite a few years ago with lawsuits that were in the, what is your checking account balance? Oh, you can probably afford this much over 6 months, right? That kind of lawsuit rate, which they made a lot of money in and really upset some people. And I don't think they're doing that as much anymore.
No.
But it's still something that you is...
I think so they realize that's a bad idea for a lot of reasons for them.
It's interesting.
Right. Especially since the technology is basically making distribution...
Free.
Free.
Yeah.
It's essentially zero, especially when you're using BitTorrent.
I got to take the shows by year and BitTorrent them up and just host them. I never do it, but I should just
do that. Download them.
Could I do that off of the little tiny Raspberry Pi computer?
I'm sure the Raspberry Pi would be struggling to keep up with the
six people that downloaded it.
Yeah.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah.
Oh, well, I'll have to get something smaller.
It's a really brilliant solution.
So, Ben, in the last, since I've known you, you've become a pretty successful web developer. In fact, you're a mobile web developer. You develop for Android and iOS web applications. And it was really fun last week when Miles was in town. All of us went out afterwards. We all talked shop because we all do that, which is kind of neat. You two more professionally than me. But what's going on? So now that you're fully, like, that's one of your big things you do, you must hate Internet Explorer as much as I do.
Well, it's...
But tell us an update on browsers, would you?
It's interesting nowadays because we don't have to worry about IE6 so much anymore. I mean, unless we're Amazon.com, if we lose 0.5% of our website visitors, who cares? You know, we're not losing too much revenue. But we've been kind of, as web developers, we all have been watching the web browsers and how many people are using the different web browsers. Yeah. So Internet Explorer has all of these issues. It's just really bad at rendering websites. It's got security issues. And if you're developing for that platform as well as every other browser out there, that's the one that's really difficult. However, that's the one that most people use. So I don't know if you guys remember, we talked about a month and a half ago, we talked about how one of the companies that tracks how many people are using these web browsers said for the first time, Chrome had a top spot, moment of glory, where it was above IE and also above everyone in terms of how many people are using it. And that happened to be on a Sunday. Recently, StatCounter, which is another company that does this, they wrote a post about how Chrome got a moment of top spot glory. That was also on a Sunday.
Why?
It turns out that people, if you were to infer from this data, right?
Mm-hmm.
On weekdays, people use Internet Explorer much more than they use Chrome. Like, we're talking 3 percentage points difference.
On weekdays, Internet Explorer is used more than on the weekends.
On weekends, people go home and they use Google Chrome because they don't like using IE.
This is exactly the thing.
Because they're listening to Geekspeak and saying, oh, they keep saying that Internet Explorer is bad. I should use something else like Chrome.
Well, every time we talk about browsers and how frustrating it is, Miles brings up this really good point, the reason why Internet Explorer is used so much. Miles, you want to tell that story again?
Is because large enterprises are still using it.
Mm-hmm.
That's basically the main... For all intents and purposes, that's the only ones who are using Internet Explorer 6 and 7 anymore.
At least in the U.S.
Why did they do that? Why does the large corporation stay with such an old browser? It seems like there'd be more security problems.
Because a couple of reasons. One is that they have internal web apps that were made with IE6's rendering engine in mind.
Mm-hmm.
And so they don't want to have to recertify and retest and worry about any bugs.
Mm.
They have something that works.
So you upgrade, everything breaks. Right. Inside your network.
Right.
You have to develop and everything, yeah.
The other is that the IT staff, you know, has requirements that are given to them. Like, we need to be able to access X, Y, and Z, and need to be able to do this in a certain manner. And for them, Internet Explorer is pretty easily manageable from a central site.
Mm-hmm.
And through what are known as group policies
right.
on a Windows network. And they're able to tie down, like, people are not able to add, you know, put in add-ins, you know, or put in extensions or extra toolbars or
let's say the company decides, hey, we need to do this one extra thing. It might be actually really difficult to do that in Internet Explorer. You know, we want this to work now in Internet Explorer. It might be kind of difficult, but imagine them having to retool everybody's computer, install a new thing, make an entire new package for delivery and maintenance versus this one little step. So the one little step happens, and the one little step happens over and over and over again. So you build this whole system, this whole environment around Internet Explorer. And that's why people get trapped.
So there's inertia
there. Internet Explorer 6.
Internet Explorer 6, right.
Yeah, that was released in 2001.
You know,
that's like infinity years ago in in computer language.
You know, when Miles and I met, Miles was on the hiring committee at a small startup that no longer exists anymore called Feed the Monster Media. And Miles hired me. I was the UI developer for the internal tools. And I had some experience in ASP using Visual Basic as the language, scripting language. And they were using, we were using whatever browser we wanted. We were using a lot of Microsoft stuff. So we were using Internet Explorer for all the people that need to edit content. And I was making a content management system. And so I went ahead and put VBScript in the web pages. Can you imagine? Just disgusts me now. But that was the easiest way to accomplish the goal. And we did accomplish the goal with this really horrible VBScript app.
That app would never work on anything other than Internet
right.
Explorer.
And I can imagine, you know, the radio station saying, hey, we need this one extra feature. Well, we put that one extra feature. We keep on doing that until you have it. If the company would have stayed around, that company might still be running Internet Explorer in these major bloated, badly designed web apps that I was used to create.
We
would have just fired you and then rewritten it.
Also, luckily, the company went out of business. We didn't have to go through that disgusting qualities.
Also, China's at something like 25% of IE6 usage for IE6 usage.
Right. China is a special case because there's such a high rate of piracy there.
Yeah.
And they cannot hook up to the Microsoft update servers because mm-hmm. then you're found to not be a valid version of Windows.
Yeah.
And so I've had some friends of mine go over to China, and the amount of viruses and malware that are present on every computer, everywhere, every laptop are amazing.
It's like a breeding ground.
Hey. So to the extent where that friend of mine who was over there, well, one of them that was over there with his laptop, he connects up to the network. And his antivirus starts going wild. Like, all these, like, messages are coming up, like, this trying to get in. And he talks to the IT administrator there and says, hey, what's going on here? Like, this is going crazy. And he's like, oh, yeah, you can just turn this off. You can just flip this setting and the messages won't come up anymore.
Oh.
That was the answer. Just, yeah, it's happening, but, you know, just here's how you can get some work done and don't have to worry about it anymore. Even though you're constantly under assault by these viruses, you're basically in the middle of a hot zone.
Yeah. Oh my God. That's ridiculous. Really, really quick note, because I don't want to cover this as a story, but there is a Mac Trojan that's out in the wild. It's infected 600,000 Macs. So
what's it called? App Store?
It's called Flashback. Flashback. No, Flashback. It's a Flashback Trojan. And they're finding it's mostly coming in from Russian sites and things like that, and exploiting a vulnerability and getting onto the machines.
How do you deal with it?
You install the Apple update. So Everyone who has a Mac, click the little Apple in the upper left-hand corner and click Software Update and run all the stuff that's there.
Do that. You really should be doing that. Yeah.
Yeah. Do that all the time.
And if you've got like a kind of portable computer, or even not so much portable computer, and you don't have a good internet connection, because lots of times people don't do those updates because it takes so long, it might be time to visit a friend with a good internet connection. If you have a laptop, definitely. Go to a cafe. It won't take that long. But, you know, it's one of those things that you really kind of need to do.
It's
this.
Really important because, if you get a Trojan and...
You know, just yesterday I ran into a PhD student who was going, I've got a Mac virus, and I think, and I'm like, I don't think you do. That's they exist, but they're very rare. I haven't really seen
them.
And
they're not usually in the wild.
But now 600,000, that's enough.
I know.
Sorry.
So this is, I mean, this is just recent. Like, this just popped on my radar just like that, you know? So
in a second, Ben's going to cover the future. Traveling.
I am.
Yeah, flying cars, baby. But first, what's up with U.S. government, Mr. Elam?
With regard to the U.S. government, there is a server or a service known as Mega Upload.
Mm-hmm.
They were a file sharing site.
Yes.
They were shut down recently by the government because the Motion Picture Association of America was saying they have a whole lot of copywritten material that's being shared on their server, and they're not taking it down and responding to us fast enough, so we want you to shut down the service. And they went through they're still in the process of legal challenges, but the site has been down for quite some time. Problem is, Mega Upload doesn't own the servers that it's running on.
Yeah.
They were co-locating.
Right.
And there's a company known as Carpathia, which was originally housing the servers. And what they want is they want to be able to take those servers, wipe them clean, and start reselling them or reusing them in some way.
Oh, right, because they're not making their money from Mega Upload anymore.
Right, because it's just sitting in a warehouse and no one's paying the bills. But the U.S. government is saying, no, you can't wipe it because they have evidence. And saying, well, what evidence do they have? Because they haven't mentioned any specific items. There's the individual users that have been cited here, but...
Well, I mean, there's copyrighted material on the machines, right? I mean,
that's the original reason why it was taken down, and the Motion Picture Association of America has to make, has to say this is what was being shared on this by this person on this date, that type of thing. But with those, and this is 600 servers, so it's not a Facebook level, but it's a non-trivial amount of hardware. The U.S. government has now put up the statement to the courts saying, we hear there's child porn on those servers, so you can't wipe them because we need to be able to search them. In other words, it's that whole, there might be something bad.
Sort of search all of it and invade everybody's privacy.
Yeah, let's try to get permission to be able to look at everything.
That's just like the magic political buzzword, isn't it? You just say that there's child pornography on something and the government can do anything they want with it.
Well, for a lot of people, music piracy and movie piracy are those same types of things. Like, oh, that's a bad thing. Well, we can do something to stop that. You say child porn, and it's like, even though violence on children has been actually on the...
Decrease, at least
child kidnappings. Whereas everyone's still, hyped up about it. And I'm not trying to belittle it.
No, I mean, it's a serious issue. Absolutely.
Right. But you say, for the children, and suddenly, and this doesn't just go for computer tech, this goes for a lot of things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Everyone will say, like, oh, well, you don't want to be against the children.
The other thing about this is that, the Mega Upload's been labeled as a piracy system. It's not. It's a file sharing system that's on the cloud, if you will, on the internet, right? So I can upload stuff, other people can download from me, and potentially there could be anything in there. Genealogical information would be something that I might want to share with lots of people, lots of my extended cousin family, all these births and deaths of everybody in my family, right? That's a perfect example of something I might want to share in that way. I choose who gets to download it. It's a small network of people. Now, all that data is off being protected somewhere by the federal government when they want to search it and look through it, because there might be somewhere in somebody else's files somewhere, there might be something that shows that children are being abused. Now, I believe it's very hard to say, no, don't do that. Because, of course, I want to find out if children are being abused and I want to stop that. That's a core aspect of being a human, right? So right away, it's a very, like, immediately, it's a difficult thing for me to say, stop, stop, stop. Let's be sane about this. But somebody's got to do that, because that excuse can go really far. Mm-hmm. You know, the Salem witch hunts examples of that, right? You get fanatical about something.
The federal government did not say there is child pornography on there and we need to be able to search them. They said, quote, may contain child pornography.
And, you know, what about searching? What about the rights of privacy first? You know, first, you know, have some reasonable requirements for search.
Right. And I do have a lot of sympathy for the company Carpathia that owns these servers, is that they have to just sit, and these servers have to be idle. They have to be just sitting in a warehouse waiting for the judge to make a decision about it or about them. And if they wipe the servers, then Carpathia could be sued by the people who own the
and
stuff.
And they can't
on
make money
servers.
Off that hardware that they've invested in.
Right.
And what about just getting a data storage facility and moving all the data onto that? I guess it's probably more complicated than that.
But the data is also what's at question in the case.
Right.
They don't want to release the data because the Motion Picture Association of America doesn't want them to release the data because they're asserting that a lot of the data has copyrighted content. And they don't want it to be distributed again.
It's an interesting problem. Thank you so much for covering it. Ben, are we in the future yet?
That's a really difficult question to parse and to answer. But we do now have a flying car. A lot of people have been saying that this is the first flying car, and it's pretty cool. It flies like a gyrocopter, which is a helicopter that goes forward, and it can land and take off at relatively low velocities. And
Its helicopter blades rotate forward? Is that how it works? Because helicopters fly forward, too.
Imagine a helicopter,
too.
But it also has a rotor, like a propeller.
In the front.
On the back.
On the back.
Pushing back.
Okay.
Yeah, and so it has to be going forward in order to take off or land because of the way the blades are tilted and everything.
Okay.
But that gives it certain other advantages as well. And it's got a good range, too. 220 miles to 315 miles is the range that they're putting up on their website.
I want to. How much do I spend?
Right. Oh, the other thing is, if you want to do this, it's like 20 to 30 hours of training. It's nothing, except you need to get one, and I'm sure they're going to be extremely expensive and very, very limited.
We've covered flying cars many times, so the question I have
this one actually made a successful maiden voyage.
Okay, that's good.
A series of maiden
No
voyages.
One died the first flight.
No one died the first several flights.
Is it completely human operated, or is there a
human
AI
operated.
In it? To,
yeah,
that sounds bad.
I know, right? Airspace and whatnot. But hey, if you want to cross that fjord over there, maybe it might be a...
We don't even have fjords over here. This is Geek Speak, and it's a registered service mark of online tonight. It's actually just by a registered service mark of David Lawrence, and we thank him for its use. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KSP Santa Cruz. We're streaming and broadcasting at KSP.org. Geek Speak on KSP is supported by EcoStruction, a Santa Cruz-based sustainable serving Northern California for 15 years. EcoStruction seeks to design, plan, and build without compromising the need of future generations. Information online at ecostruction.com. That's ecostruction.com. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the Arum with me was Mr. Ben Jaffe. A little late, but we
still
thank you for
here.
Being here. And via Skype from somewhere in California is Mr. Miles Elam. Thank you so much, Miles, for being here as well.
Always a pleasure.
See you next week.